all that is needed is for one bomb, one nuclear bomb, to land in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, and that would be the end of Israel.
It's been happening over and over that you've been lied to for 20 years. Why would you suddenly believe it and support a new war against a country that's three times as large as Iraq, risking all of the major escalation and instability and huge war that we know will happen?
And I think the decision to bomb Iran's nuclear potential arsenal is a righteous decision. It's the right thing to do. It will save lives.
This would be the worst of all of those wars because of how big Iran is, because of how sophisticated their military is. And if you thought Iraq was bad, think about what bombing Iran will entail.
Now that we've got everyone voting, we can call our debaters to the stage. The United States should strike Iran's nuclear facilities. Speaking for the affirmative, Alan Dershowitz. Alan, please come to the stage. Speaking for the negative, Glenn Greenwald. Glenn, please come to the stage. All right, guys, as you know, the timekeeper is in front. We'll be flashing 5-minute, 2-minute, and 1-minute and 30-second cards. And Professor Dershowitz prefers to use 85-year-old prerogative and do it from his chair. Alan, you have 17 and a half minutes to make your case. Please take it away, Alan.
Thank you so much. What a wonderful event. At a time when, as the moderator said, there are too few debates, too many bumper stickers, too many people cheering for one side or the other. Having a great debate about a really difficult subject is so important. Parts of me wishes this was not a debate, wishes it was a discussion, because there are arguments on both sides of this, very, very compelling arguments on both sides of this. It's a very, very difficult question. Anytime a decision is made to take preventive military action that involves cataclysmic consequences and considerations. And so I want to go over why I think the argument here favors taking such preventive military action, though I understand the consequences. We know the risks of taking preventive military action when it shouldn't have been taken. We can call those false positives. You can call them by whatever word you want to call them. But we know that that happened in Iraq when we went in thinking or believing or proclaiming or claiming that there was nuclear facilities, only to find out that there wasn't, with very tragic events for so many people, civilians and military. And a lot has been written about false positives. A lot has been written about false decisions, poor decisions to take military intervention in a preventive way. But not enough has been written about or considered about the risks of not taking preventive action when preventive action is necessary and would save lives and would do a great deal of good in the world. History provides lots of examples of failures to act when action might have prevented catastrophic harms, and I'm going to argue that this is one such situation. Perhaps the most telling example of the failure to act was the failure of Great Britain and France to enforce the Versailles Treaty by taking preventive military action to stop the military buildup of Germany following the First World War. A military attack on Germany in 1935 or 36, when its war machine was still weak, might have prevented the Second World War with its tens of millions of deaths. Joseph Goebbels, who was the obviously propaganda minister of the Nazi regime, wrote about this in his diaries. And I hope you pay very close attention to this one paragraph because it's so critical. Here's what he said. In 1933, a French premier ought to have said, and if I had been the French premier, I would have said, this is Goebbels talking, the new Reich Chancellor is the man who wrote Mein Kampf, which says this and that. The man cannot be tolerated in our vicinity. Either he disappears or we march. But they didn't do it. They let us slip through the risky zone, and we were able to sail around the dangerous reefs. And when we were done and well-armed, better than they, he then says they started the war. Of course, Germany started the war, but the point is still the same. The rest, we know, is tragic history. Germany built up its armed forces without countermeasures by its intended enemies and conquered most of Western Europe, killing tens of millions of people. Most of these deaths could almost certainly have been prevented had Great Britain and France engaged in preventive military action before Germany became well-armed. But at that moment in history, when Great Britain and France could have prevented the horrendous harm known ultimately caused by Nazi Germany, there was no way of knowing in advance, predicting the extent of what Hitler will do. History is blind to the future. History only knows the past. Yes, he wrote Mein Kampf, but many conquerors, would-be conquerors, do not follow through on their threats. Recall Khrushchev's threat to bury the United States, yet he backed away from a nuclear confrontation over Cuba. There was no way of predicting with any degree of certainty that Hitler would personally turn his belligerent rhetoric into military invasions of Poland, the Soviet Union, and then, obviously, the Holocaust. As always, it was a question of cost-benefit probabilities. This was a classic case of a false negative, implicitly predicting that Hitler would not do what he in fact did, and failing to take actions in order to prevent it. If France and Great Britain had accurately predicted the actual harms, they would almost certainly have taken preventive action, even if the costs were high, because it would never have been nearly as high as it turned out to be in the absence of such action. But, as I say, history is blind. Had Great Britain and France decided to take preventive military actions in the mid-1930s and done so successfully, no one would ever know what was prevented. And Churchill, if he had been the prime minister in the middle 30s, and he would have predicted that Hitler would kill tens of millions of people unless he was stopped, he would have been attacked by the international community, by the world. He would have been disbelieved, even mocked, as Clement Attlee was mocked for taking military action against Egypt in 1956. Had Great Britain and France engaged in preventive military action that resulted in, say, the deaths of 10,000 Germans and 5,000 British and French soldiers and civilians, the leaders who undertook such a military adventure would have been condemned as war criminals, because no one would ever know how many deaths they prevented by the sacrifice of those 15,000 lives. Ignorance of the hypothetical future is often the reason for failure to act in the present. Had Great Britain and France acted, everyone would know that about the 15,000 deaths that their actions caused, while no one would know about the tens of millions of lives their actions saved. We now talk about the tens of millions of deaths these leaders indirectly caused or at least made possible by not taking preventive military action, but we don't accuse them of actually causing these deaths, because inaction that directly lead to death is not generally blamed as much as actions that visibly produce a body count. That is the dilemma of invisible false positives in failing to take military action A preventive attack would not have been cost-free, and it was not undertaken because the British and the French did not accurately predict and assess the cost of not acting. The result was catastrophic and preventable. I believe we're at that moment now. If the United States, with or without the support of Israel, or Israel with the support of the United States, were to take preventive military action to destroy Iran's capability of creating a nuclear arsenal, deaths would result. People would be killed. When Israel attacked the Osirak nuclear reactor in Iraq in the early 1980s, there were a few deaths, not very many, a few. And we're not sure what it could have prevented. We don't know what Saddam Hussein would have done had he had nuclear weapons. Again, this is clearly in the area of probabilities. But I believe, and I think many military analysts believe, that Iran would keep its promise. Remember the former president of Iran, Rafsanjani, who was more liberal than the man who died this morning, and more willing to consider making peace. Rafsanjani stated back a few years ago that if Iran were to develop a nuclear arsenal and bomb Israel, it would be the end of Israel because Israel is a one-bomb state. All that is needed is for one bomb, one nuclear bomb, to land in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, and that would be the end of Israel. And he said, and he was wrong about this, and I'll explain why in a minute, that Israel would retaliate and perhaps kill 10 million Muslims by bombing Tehran. But Rafsanjani said the trade-off would be worth it because it would mean the end of the Jewish state and Islam would still survive. Can a nation that makes those kinds of claims and predictions be allowed to become nuclear armed? I believe not. And I believe that preventive action must be taken. Let me make another argument that will be very unpopular here tonight, but I'm going to make it. When Israel bombed the Iraqi nuclear reactor at Osirak, Begin was asked to explain why. Menachem Begin, who was the prime minister. And he said the reason is simple, because Israel cannot ever take deterrent action after the fact. What did he mean? What he said was that if Iraq were to bomb Israel, Israel would not retaliate by bombing Baghdad. And he said why? He said because Israeli pilots would refuse to drop nuclear bombs on a civilian area like Baghdad. And he said, therefore, Israel does not have the deterrent threat that other countries have. The United States dropped two nuclear bombs, obviously. Israel would not. And therefore, Israel, he said, had to use preventive action. And he wanted that to become a precedent for all future Israeli governments. We're talking about the United States now, but we're talking about the United States in combination, obviously, with Israel. Neither country could probably, or would country, would probably do it alone. And so there are four issues, really, when one thinks about this decision. One is the righteousness of the decision. And I think the decision to bomb Iran's nuclear potential arsenal is a righteous decision. It's the right thing to do. It will save lives based on cost-benefit analysis, particularly if it could be done with minimum civilian casualties, the way the Iraqi nuclear reactor and the Syrian nuclear reactor both were destroyed with minimum civilian casualties. The potential benefits considerably outweigh the potential risks. Having said that, the next is legality. Let me talk about legality. I would ask, if it were a smaller audience, for a Trivial Pursuit question, but I'll ask it and then answer it. What is the first country in modern history ever to attack another country's nuclear facilities in a preventive way? You might say the United States, and the answer will surprise you. The answer is Iran. Iran, in the early 1980s, bombed the Osarik nuclear reactor. Remember, Iran and Iraq were in a war together. And Iran bombed the Osarik nuclear reactor before Israel did. And it's one of the bases on which Israel made the decision that it could be done. And it damaged the facility, but it didn't put it out of business. Israel then put it out of business. So when one talks about legality, one talks about precedent, but one also talks about whether or not there's a casus belli, whether or not it would be proper for the United States or Israel to attack the nuclear reactor in Iran. And the answer is clearly yes. Iran, we know, killed over 300 Marines in Beirut, Lebanon, back in the 1980s. That was a casus belli. The Argentinian Supreme Court just 2 weeks ago ruled that Iran was responsible for the murder of hundreds of Israelis in the Israeli embassy and the Israeli community center in Buenos Aires. Those were attacks by Iran against Israel. And of course, we know that Iran sent many, many rockets and missiles, to Israel just 2 or 3 weeks ago. All of them but one were repelled, but nonetheless, that was a casus belli. And so there is absolutely no doubt legally that Israel and the United States have the complete right to retaliate against what Iran has done. It doesn't have to base it even on prevention, although prevention is a strong basis for it. But it has the right to do it in a retaliatory way as well. And so we're now left with the likelihood of success and the ramifications. I am not an expert on military action, so I can't really comment on the likelihood of a success. Israel and the United States would not undertake such an action unless it thought the likelihood of success was very high. And then we finally move to what is maybe one of the hardest questions, the ramifications. What would happen? The Middle East is aflame. It's aflame more this morning than it was last night with the death of the former president of Iran. We know that Iran has sworn to the destruction of Israel. Of course, it calls the United States the great Satan and Israel the small Satan. And so the ramifications are unpredictable, and the ramifications of inaction are unpredictable. And so I will not sit here and tell you that I am absolutely certain, that I am positive that it's the right action to take. I will tell you that based on what I know, and I've spoken to many of the leaders of both of our countries, that the risks of inaction in this case, the risks of Iran actually crossing the threshold and developing a nuclear arsenal is so much greater than the risks of North Korea or Pakistan or China or Russia having nuclear weapons. After all, Iran is the greatest transmitter of terrorism around the world. It has as its surrogates organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah, which would never hesitate for one moment to use nuclear bombs against the United States and against Israel. So on balance, though I concede right away it's a close question, I am in favor of a surgical, strategic, military attack that was designed and could succeed in preventing Iran from crossing the threshold into developing a nuclear arsenal. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Glenn Greenwald will take the podium. 17 and a half minutes. Take it away, Glenn.
So first of all, let me begin by thanking the Soho Forum and Reason Foundation for this debate. I agree with Professor Dershowitz and everybody else that we need a lot more debates like this, especially when we have so many people in our country who constantly want to sell Americans on the virtues of all kinds of exciting and very dangerous new wars. So I want to begin by saying that, unlike Professor Dershowitz, I don't actually think this is a very hard question. I don't think it's a very complex question. That's always what is said whenever it's time to sell a new war. Oh, there's such good arguments on both sides. We have to be very careful about analyzing them. It might be the case that if what we were really debating is this very pretty picture presented by the resolution that Professor Dershowitz just got done advocating, that, oh, all we're going to do is fly a few fighter jets over Iran, and we're just going to do little pinpricks, very precise bombs on their nuclear facilities, and that's all we're going to do, I would still ask, what is the benefit of that? The way in which countries proliferate nuclear weapons is through the know-how of their scientists, which you don't eliminate unless you want to kill them too. It's through persuading them, convincing them that they would be safer without nuclear weapons than with nuclear weapons. But the reality is that is not actually what we're discussing. That's the pretense of the war. Every war that we've been sold, from Vietnam to Iraq to the regime change wars of Libya and Syria to the war in Afghanistan, all have had pretext and pretenses to make them seem so much easier, so much more difficult, so much more deliberate and targeted than they really were. So let me just begin by saying what Professor Dershowitz is really advocating for. And I don't mean that I'm going to read into his soul and try and intuit his motives. I'm going to quote from Professor Dershowitz only 3 weeks ago, where he spoke on the extremely highly esteemed news outlet called Newsmax. And this is what he said he actually wants when it comes to Iran. The headline of the Newsmax article, and this is from April 14, 2024, barely 3 weeks ago, Dershowitz to Newsmax, Iran's attacks won't end without regime change. And the article says, attacks like those that unfolded Saturday against Israel from Iran will happen, quote, again and again, and wars in Gaza, Lebanon, and Yemen will never end as long as the Ayatollahs remain in charge of Iran. So the only solution is regime change, Harvard Law Professor Emeritus Alan Dershowitz argued on Newsweek Sunday, quote, and this is quoting Professor Dershowitz. He won't tell you this tonight because he wants to pretend. He just wants a little limited pinprick of a bombing campaign. But this is actually what he wants in his own words. Quote, the only solution is regime change. There must be a change of regime and a return to an Iran which is democratic. 70% of Iranians want regime change, and 90% of Arab states, meaning the U.S.-supported Arab dictators, in the region want regime change. He then went on to say, regime change would be carried out through an attack by the United States, which would be aimed at Iran. And then he added, quote, I had dinner the other night with the Shah of Iran's son, the crown prince of Iran, the man who would turn Iran into a democracy if the people of Iran were allowed to vote and return the Shah's family to the rule. But it's not going to happen if the United States does not do a regime change on Iran. So it's not that he just wants a regime change operation on Iran. He wants to reinstall the Shah of Iran's son in the name of spreading democracy and freedom to Iran, just like we did to Afghanistan, just like we did to Vietnam, just like we did to Iraq. And you see what happened there. This is exactly the same propaganda, the exact same mentality, the exact same interest at work. Now, just to remind you, to say that I'm going to bring return democracy to Iran by reinstalling the regime of the Shah's family, of the Pahlavi regime and dynasty, is like saying, oh, I want to bring freedom and democracy to the world by making Mohammed bin Salman not just the head of Saudi Arabia, but of the entire world. The whole way that the Shah of Iran was installed in the first place was that the Iranians had a democratically elected government that the United States didn't and the West didn't like because it was becoming too nationalistic. It was threatening to nationalize oil reserves and use the proceeds for the benefit of the American people. The CIA overthrew that democratically elected government and planted one of the most brutal and savage dictators the world has ever seen, which is the Shah of Iran, who killed and murdered and put into prison every single dissident and ran that country with an iron fist until there was a revolution in 1979. That is what's really going on here. The reason people like Alan Dershowitz and the CIA in the West wanted to install the Shah and love the Shah and want to return the Shah into Iran
isn't because they love democracy and want to spread democracy to the Middle East. It's because the Shah of Iran was a very close ally of Israel and a very close puppet, a very obedient puppet of the United States. And that is what this entire Middle East framework is about, is taking out the leaders who are democratically elected, making sure that the people of the Middle East have no say whatsoever by imposing dictators on those countries which we support and prop up, as we're doing in Saudi Arabia and Egypt and the United Arab Emirates and Qatar and Jordan. They want to turn the Middle East into all of that, where there's nothing but puppets of the United States that are very subservient to Israel. That is the real image, in his own words. He's saying, what I really want is regime change, and I want to reinstall the Shah of Iran into that country in order to spread democracy. Now, let me just make a couple of points about a couple of the propagandistic visions that Professor Dershowitz presented. The first one is, he wants you to think that we're right around the corner from having another Hitler, another Nazi Germany, and therefore you should make all your decisions based on what we wish we would have done prior to the emergence of Adolf Hitler and Nazi Germany. When I first stopped being a lawyer and began writing about politics in 2005, one of the very first things I noticed was how it seems like our pundit class, our policymaking class, our political class knows only one historical example. It's like they didn't learn anything about history except 1938, Neville Chamberlain, Winston Churchill, and the Nazis. And so everything they want you to believe always should be decided through the scope of the Nazis are coming, Hitler has returned. Now, there's a phrase in law, which I'm sure Professor Dershowitz at Harvard has taught his students, that says, bad cases make bad law. In other words, if you're deciding everything based on some extreme case that's very uncommon, you're going to make very bad decisions for other cases that are more common. We have been told over the past 30 years that every single leader we want to go to war with is the new Hitler. We heard that about Saddam Hussein. We heard that about Ho Chi Minh. We heard that about Assad. We heard that about Gaddafi. We hear now that about Hamas, that Hamas is worse than the Nazis, or worse than ISIS. We've heard that about Mohammed Ahmadinejad, who, if you probably don't remember that Hitler, he was the one who left after serving two terms, which the Constitution required. This is the standard propagandistic framework they always sell to you to scare you into thinking that the new Hitler is about to come and therefore we have to take action. But what makes Hitler Hitler, what makes the Nazis Nazis, is that it was a singular evil, unlike things we've seen in history either before or since. And so to let our government or pundits or warmongers scare us all the time into believing that the new Hitler is coming, we're again facing Nazi Germany, is to make extremely bad decisions, always in favor of war, because of course, who wouldn't want to go kill Hitler before he became Hitler? And that's what they want you to think, but that's not actually what we're facing. Now, as far as the claim that, oh, well, we can't wait for proof because the only proof that we're going to have is when Iran finally gets the nuclear bomb, that should be very familiar to anybody above the age of 30, because that is what we were told before the Iraq War, when people like Condoleezza Rice were asked, well, where's the evidence of all these nuclear weapons that you say Saddam Hussein has? She said, we can't wait for the proof to be in the form of a smoke cloud, of a nuclear cloud over the United States. So that was what they were saying, was, oh, we don't have any evidence that Iran has nuclear weapons. We don't have any evidence that they're going to use them, but we can't wait. We have to do preventive war, which was a brand new concept for Iraq that he now wants to bring back for Iran. Prior to the war in Iraq, there was no such thing as preventive war. There was preemptive war, meaning if a country was on the verge of attacking you, you had the right to attack them. Obviously, Iraq wasn't on the verge of attacking the United States in 2002 and 2003, so they invented a new term called preventive war that allowed the United States to go into Iraq, one of the worst foreign policy disasters in the history of our country. And I would simply ask you whether you want to repeat that, because everything that he just got done saying is what we were told in 2002 and 2003 and so many other times as well, including in Syria and in Libya. Now, it's not just Professor Dershowitz who wants regime change in Iran. It's also the government of Israel. We have this amazing coincidence in our foreign policy over the last 20 years that we keep getting told that we, the United States and Americans, have to go to war just totally coincidentally against all of Israel's worst enemies. So we went to war against Saddam Hussein, who Israel hated so much that they actually worked with and armed the Iranians in their war against Iraq. The we tried to pull President Assad, Bashar al-Assad, out of Syria, who the Israelis saw as an extension of Iran. We ended up fighting on the same side as al-Qaeda and ISIS to do so. We failed. We left that country in complete destruction. We were told that we have to remove Gaddafi in Libya, even though we had partnered with him for so long, because he was one of the most pro-Palestinian voices in the region. We did actually remove Gaddafi from power, even though President Obama swore that the purpose of the war was simply to protect the people of Benghazi. It had nothing to do with regime change, and we got that leader out as well. So in 2021, according to the Times of Israel, it reported the following, quote, Defense Minister of Israel Benny Gantz and Mossad Chief David Bonera will push during their meetings this week in Washington with senior Biden administration officials for the United States to carry out a military strike on Iranian targets, Israel's three main TV news broadcasts reported Saturday night. So on some level, I would argue that just bombing Iran is not actually good for Israel's national security, but there is no world in which bombing Iran, which is what he wants our country to do, bomb Iran, having the United States bomb Iran, would actually benefit our national security as well. Now, let me just remind you of all the different times over the past, say, 20 years that we have heard over and over everything about Iran that Professor Dershowitz is trying to scare you into believing that they're just about to get nuclear weapons, they're weeks away, they're months away, we have to go bomb them. This is not something that only began recently. In fact, we've been hearing this exact same thing for 20 years, and none of it ever came true. So you should decide tonight whether there's any reason, after hearing this for 20 years, you're now suddenly willing to believe that Iran is on the verge of getting nuclear weapons to the point that we have to go start a new war with Iran. Jeffrey Goldberg, who's the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic and a strong supporter of Israel, wrote a cover story for The Atlantic called The Point of No Return in 2010, where he told Americans it was more than 50% likely that the Israelis were about to go bomb Iran in the next 3 months because they didn't have more than months before Iran finally acquired a nuclear weapon. You can go all the way back to 2005. Where NBC News reported the following. This is 2005, 20 years ago, quote, Israel should take, quote, bold and courageous action against arch foe Iran's nuclear program, similar to its 1981 strike on the main Iraqi reactor, former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Sunday. Israeli officials have said that unless stopped, Iran will achieve the know-how to build a bomb by March of next year. In 2010, Jeffrey Goldberg said, based on my conversations with Israeli decision makers, in Israel, we heard this as 9 months from June. In other words, March of 2011, that's all Israel has. If we assume that nothing changes in these estimates, this will mean we have to begin thinking about our next step beginning at the turn of the year. The New York Times in 2012, President Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel told the UN that Iran's capability to enrich uranium must be stopped before next spring or early summer, arguing that by the time the country will be in a position to make a short, undetectable sprint to manufacture nuclear weapons. Reuters in 2015, CBS in 2018, BBC in 2019 all say exactly the same thing. Oh, we're only months away. We have for sure these intelligence photos with a big red arrow pointing at some random building that we have discovered is where Iran is about to proliferate their nuclear weapons. It's been happening over and over that you've been lied to for 20 years. Why would you suddenly believe it and support a new war against a country that's three times as large as Iraq, risking all of the major escalation and instability and huge war that we know will happen? Now, if you want Iran not to build a nuclear weapon, there is a very easy way to do that, which is to signal to them that the safest way for them to reintegrate into the international community is by agreeing not to build a nuclear weapon in exchange for having sanctions lifted. That was the Iran deal that President Obama did in 2015. And according to the Congressional Research Service, in April of 2024, just a month ago, when he was telling Newsmax what he really wants is a regime change in Iran, they documented how during the entire Iran deal, when sanctions were lifted, Iran never took any steps to build a nuclear weapon beyond what they were allowed to do. They had everything open to inspectors. They were always doing exactly what that agreement called for. And it was only once that deal was terminated, which the Israelis and many Israel supporters in the United States urged President Trump to do, did we begin again hearing that they were close to nuclear weapons. The 1981 example that he cites often about when Israel bombed Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi reactor is the perfect example. Prior to 1981, there was almost no evidence Saddam Hussein had an active nuclear program. It was a very vague aspiration. What drove Iraq to try and get nuclear weapons was precisely the fact that Israel attacked them. That's the message we send to the world all the time. If you have nuclear weapons, if you're North Korea or if you're Pakistan, we won't mess with you. If you give up your nukes, though, the way Saddam Hussein did or the way Gaddafi did, that is when you're vulnerable to regime change. We've created a world where the incentive is to get nuclear weapons through the kind of aggression and militarism that he advocates. According to a Washington Post op-ed by defense official Colin Call, he said, and he cited several academic studies, that after the 1981 bombing by Israel in Iraq, quote, the Iraqi nuclear program increased from a program of 400 scientists and $400 million to one of 7,000 scientists and $10 billion. And this is what we've seen over and over, that when you, as the United States, say, we're going to rule the world by force, we're going to go bomb whoever we want, that sends the signal to the world that you better get nuclear weapons. That's the only protection for against that. But when the United States cooperates with countries and reaches deals with countries and opens up those countries like we had with Iran, that is when the world becomes much safer. That is when you take away the incentive for countries to get nuclear weapons. Bombing Iran will have no effect on their nuclear capability. Maybe it'll set it back by a year or so. And then what are you going to do, bomb them again? You're going to increase the incentive for them to get it. But what I can guarantee you will happen is that exactly what we saw in Iraq, there will be destruction throughout the region. Even Tony Blair, one of the most vocal advocates of the war in Iraq, admitted that the main result of invading Iraq was to create instability and a vacuum of power in the region that gave rise to ISIS. And you can look at every study, including from the Brookings Institution, from all kinds of think tanks that usually are not shy about supporting war. And what they will say, they will have a long list of horribles about the kind of infiltration and fire that will set out in the Middle East if we do something like try and a little pinprick on Iran. Even if that were in the most ideal world was our goal, that will not be the result. We saw what Iran did by Israel. He forgot to mention this when he was talking about Iran sending those missiles over to Israel. It was preceded by something that happened, which was Israel went to Syria and bombed a consulate of Iran, something that every country would react to that way. The more we attack countries in the Middle East, the more we destabilize the Middle East, the more death and destruction we bring with no benefit, the more we try and cooperate and bring a world of peace, the less threat of nuclear weapons you will find. Thank you.
Thank you. Seven and a half minutes of rebuttal. 7.5 minutes of rebuttal from Alan Dershowitz. Take it away, Alan.
Israel, of course. For posterity.
Israel succeeded in its attacks on both the Iraqi and the Syrian nuclear reactors with minimal casualties. And neither Syria nor Iraq has continued to develop nuclear weapons. The Middle East is a lot safer because of Israel's surgical attacks, careful attacks, very, very cautious attacks on both Iraq and Syria's nuclear reactors. Now, I would love to see Israel be able to cooperate with Iran and work out a deal and try to avoid them getting nuclear weapons or a nuclear arsenal without an attack. That would be far, far better. But it's just not going to happen. And there are some very, very thoughtful people who now honestly believe that Iran is just months away from having a nuclear arsenal and enough bombs to destroy Israel. And of course, we know that Iran operates through surrogates. It operates through far less responsible organizations such as Hamas and Bala and the Houthis and others. And the idea that any of them would get nuclear weapons is so potentially disturbing to world peace that it's worth at least considering what the realistic options are. If Iran does develop a nuclear arsenal, it will change everything in the Middle East. It will change everything in the world. And remember, because Iran is a theocracy, which bases its decisions on the leaders of the Ayatollah, a kind of cataclysmic approach which focuses more on the world to come than on this world is not beyond the realm of dispute. And the question is a question of probabilities. Nobody knows for absolute certain. Nobody knows with any degree of prophecy. You know, the Bible says that, or the Talmud says, the prophecy ended with the destruction of the Second Temple. And so we're left with a world of probabilities. And one has to ask what the worst probabilities are. And the question is, what would be worse? A preventive attack on a nascent Iranian a nuclear arsenal, or leaving it alone and allowing Iran to develop a nuclear arsenal, which would change everything in the Middle East. You know, we heard my distinguished opponent talk about how many times Israel thought about bombing Iran, but they've never done it. They've never done it, not because they didn't have the capacity to do it, but they were waiting for a much higher level of certainty and a much higher ability to do to Iran what they did to Iraq and Syria, and that is to destroy the nuclear potential without endangering civilians. For example, in Iraq, I think one civilian died, a French technician who was not supposed to be at the Osirak reactor. It was on a Saturday or something like that, or a Friday when they were supposed to be home, and accidentally he was there. And if it didn't totally destroy, it set back the Iraqi nuclear program for many years. In fact, it's never been renewed again. And so it is a question of probabilities. And yes, I favor regime change in Iran. Iran is the most dangerous country in the modern world. It is the modern day Nazi Germany. And the potential for Iran using its aggressive behavior, which it now assigns to surrogates, and doing it in a more direct, effective way. Remember that Iran sent hundreds of missiles to Israel just a few weeks ago. Imagine if a half a dozen of them were nuclear tipped. Every country has the right of self-defense, and regime change would be good for the vast majority of Iranians want regime change. The only reason there is Ayatollah regime in Iran is because it's a despotic regime. It's the furthest thing in the world from democracy. And so if the Iranian regime could be changed, look, I don't want the Shah, I don't want anybody close to the Shah to be the leader of Iran, but you have to choose between evils, and you have to choose the lesser of the evils. And I have to tell you, the Iranian regime was less bad on a scale of really bad under the Shah of Iran, and it would be much, much less bad under his far more liberal and far more accommodating a son than it would have been under the Ayatollah. So, you know, we don't live in a world of good, better, best. We live in a world of bad, worse, worser, worsest, and intolerable. And all I'm trying to do is move it from intolerable to not so bad. And that's the risk that would be incurred if the United States were to take a preventive action. And I think in the end, when you think about what the world would look like if the United States didn't, and Israel together, didn't take preventive action, and if Iran were to develop a nuclear arsenal, which it would then allocate to its even less responsible surrogates such as Hezbollah and Hamas and the Houthis, or a world in which Iran were deprived of the ability to create a nuclear arsenal? And it's a hard question. I disagree with the opening statement of my distinguished opponent that this is not a hard question. It is a very hard question. And I hope and pray we don't ever become in a situation like occurred in after Nazi Germany, where we regret not having taken action. In Nazi Germany, we had enough information and we learned to regret, and it cost millions and millions and millions of lives. I hope we never get to that situation where we look back at this debate and we regret not having taken the action that I advocate we should take.
Thank you, Professor. Seven and a half minutes from Glenn, to Wick Glenn.
So one of the first things that I noticed Professor Dershowitz saying near the beginning of his rebuttal there was, well, it would be nice to have an agreement with Iran, but unfortunately, it will never happen. And I thought that was so odd because it actually did happen, not 100 years ago, but 7 years ago. It was the Iran deal that the United States and Western Europe entered into with Iran to reintegrate Iran into the international community in exchange for Iran opening up its nuclear facilities. Think about what you would think if you were a leader. Would you want nuclear weapons more if you felt like you were endangered of being bombed and attacked and having people like Alan Dershowitz talking for the last 20 years about how important it is to bomb you within the next few weeks? Wouldn't you think, oh, I better get nuclear weapons? And wouldn't you feel like maybe you don't need nuclear weapons if you're actually entering deals that you don't renege on, but that the United States did? So that was a deal. And I read you the Congressional Service Report that said during the time of that deal, there was no movement at all on Iran's nuclear program. In fact, this is from the Brookings Institution, which supported the war in Iraq, has always supported multiple wars in the Middle East. And this is what they say in December 2021, why bombing Iran is still a bad idea. Quote, retired Israeli general Isaac Ben Israel told Bloomberg that, quote, Netanyahu's efforts to persuade the Trump administration to quit the nuclear agreement with Iran has turned out to be the worst strategic mistake in Israel's history. With this statement, General Ben Israel admitted that not only did Israel undermine its own security by pushing for Trump to renege on the agreement, but also that Israel undermined America's security, as both countries share an interest in preventing Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. Such behavior is unacceptable from a partner. Unfortunately, Iran's current minister, Naftali Bennett, is adopting much of the same posture on Iran as Netanyahu. And here's what they say will happen if you vote for bombing Iran. Quote, an Israeli strike on Iran or a U.S. strike on Iran, quote, will likely start a conflict that pulls in neighboring countries on both sides. Hezbollah will launch thousands of rockets, missiles, and drones at Haifa, Tel Aviv, and other targets. Hamas might also join the conflict. Iran or its Iraqi and Yemeni partners could strike Saudi Arabia as they have in the past. They might also expand attacks to include Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates, given their now publicly normalized ties with Israel. Oman, Kuwait, and Qatar, which have tended to maintain relations with both Israel and the rest of the United States, will be pressed to choose a side, a decision that will subject them to attack from their new adversaries. Jordan would be in a grave bind, given the enormous popular pressure to break the peace treaty with Israel. Oil prices would skyrocket. Does that sound like something we all want? This conflagration in the Middle East of the kind we saw when the people who said the same thing about Iraq got their way? Now, again, Professor Dershowitz returned to this idea that, oh, the Iranians are Nazis. I guess, I don't know if Assad is still the new Hitler. I don't know if Gaddafi's still the new Hitler. If Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who was not even part of Iran's government anymore, is the new Hitler. I don't know if Putin is the new Hitler. But Iran, he says, is the real new Nazis, and you have to treat them that way. What evidence is there that Iran is some crazy apocalyptic country that goes around murdering and slaughtering and committing genocide? They have certainly done bad acts, and Professor Dershowitz went over them. But the death count responsible that the United States and Israel is responsible for dwarfs whatever number of people Iran has killed. Iran has shown over and over that they can be rationally negotiated with. They're not some crazed apocalyptic cult. When Israel bombed their embassy in Syria, They didn't go all out and try and attack Israel the way many countries would. They used some of their slowest and most harmless drones that they knew would be intercepted as a show of symbolic force. There's no evidence that Iran is out there invading other countries, bombing other countries, trying to bring a genocide or a new Holocaust. In fact, in 2018, there was a UN General Assembly resolution that simply called for the, quote, establishment of a nuclear weapon-free zone in the region of the Middle East. All 171 countries voted in favor of a nuclear-free Middle East. You'll never guess which were the only two no votes in the entire world. Oh, it's the U.S. and Israel. That's who voted no on a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East. Now, one of the things that I think we need to ask ourselves is what would be the effect of bombing Iran versus what would be the effect of returning to something like the Iran deal. Here's the Brookings Institute in December of 21 again. Quote, while the talks in Vienna to restore the new Iran deal yielded little progress, this appeal marks just the latest example of the failed paradigm with which both the United States and Israel have approached Iran, the belief that greater pressure and more aggression will force Tehran to capitulate when the likelier outcome would be to provoke a similar military response. That has been the mistake of U.S. foreign policy for 50 years. We believe we can throw our military force around the world and force countries to immediately capitulate and submit. And instead, the exact opposite happens in war after war. We make the planet more dangerous. We incentivize countries to try and build up their military and acquire nuclear weapons to protect against that kind of single-handed aggression. Now, I cited, and he didn't even note, let alone respond to, the studies that show that after the 1981 strike by Israel on Iraq's nuclear weapons program, the model that he always likes to cite, it did not deter Iraq's nuclear program. To the contrary, it supercharged it. They quadrupled or more the amount of money they were spending to acquire nuclear weapons precisely because Israel had just attacked them. And in fact, there was by 2003, the key Iraqi nuclear scientist who were called the father of the nuclear program, who was imprisoned by Saddam during the 1981 bombing of Israel. He was in prison, and Saddam immediately let him out after the Israeli bombing because they realized that they needed to build up their nuclear arsenal. A CIA 2004 report on weapons of mass destruction said this, quote, according to a former senior official, Israel's bombing of Iraq's nuclear reactor spurred Saddam to build up Iraq's military to confront Israel in the early 1980s. Saudi Arabia gave $5 billion after the Israeli attack to Iraq under the promise that if Iraq develops nuclear weapons, Saudi Arabia would get those too. It supercharged the craving desire of the Middle East when Israel bombed for them to get nuclear weapons. It did not bring any peace or deter them at all. And I would just leave you with this quote from a very conservative former senator who became Donald Trump's director of national intelligence, Dan Coats, who in 2017 was asked about why North Korea was insisting on having the nuclear bomb. And he said this, there is rationale backing Kim Jong-un's actions, which are survival for his regime, survival for his country. And he has watched, I think, what has happened around the world relative to nations that possess nuclear capabilities and the leverage they have, and seen that having the nuclear part in your pocket results in a lot of deterrence. The lessons that we learned out of Libya giving up its nukes and Ukraine giving up its nukes, and also obviously Iraq giving up its nukes, is unfortunately, if you had nukes, never give them up. If you don't have them, get them. That is the world that has been created by the Alan Dershowitzes of the world, by the people who want the U.S. to constantly bomb other countries. We have created the world in which countries need nuclear weapons, and the proof that we can fix it with cooperation is the Iran deal that was working perfectly, as everyone says, to keep Iran out of the nuclear arms business.
We now come to the Q&A portion of the evening. There are mics over here and over there. We run this rather loosely, at any time, the debaters can ask each other a question. If you want to exercise the prerogative now, guys, please, quiet down a little bit. Excuse me? I know we have 30 minutes. I know we. What? We have a 30-minute. Thank you, Jane, for prompting an old guy. We have 30 minutes for questions. However, we will allow debaters to ask each other a question. If you would like to exercise that prerogative now or a bit later, we've got a lot of people lined up with questions. Either one. Alan, do you want to ask?
Say that again?
Do you want to ask Glenn a question?
Oh, I want to ask him a lot of questions.
Is that okay? Then maybe you want to leave the audience to ask it, or what do you want to do? You want to waive that, or you want to do it now? Go ahead.
My first question, was the world and was the Middle East a better place or a worse place under the Shah, with all the horrors and all the terrible things that the Pahlavi family and the Shah has done? Was the world safer, a better place under the Shah or under the Ayatollahs?
I mean, the only reason why that question would be relevant is because if Professor Dershowitz's real goal in pretending to convince you he wants a pinpoint strike on Iran's nuclear program is in fact what he's admitted, which is a regime change
in
Iran.
That.
And then the question becomes, oh, do we want to once again have the CIA impose a savage and brutal dictatorship on Iran? I guess the question for whether the world was better off under the Shah was who you are. If you were Israel and the CIA, outstanding. I would love the Shah if I were Israel and the CIA. The United States is bidding. If you were a dissident in Iran, if you were somebody who was religious in Iran, if you were critical of the government in Iran, things were extremely grim for you because dissidents were savaged and brutalized in prison, and that was why there were many people who overthrew
them. Let me ask you a follow-up question. If there were an open and free election today in Iran, would the Ayatollah be elected, or if there were an election, even as you put it, between the brutal Shah and the nice Ayatollahs, who do you think would win the election in Iran today?
I didn't say the Ayatollahs were nice or nice Ayatollahs.
Who would win the election?
I think that.
Who would win?
I'm not a pollster, even in the United States.
But you're talking about democracy.
I don't think we know what the population. Hold on. You can't just constantly interrupt. What I want to say is that if you look at history, what you will find is that the world is better off, is worse off, and the countries are worse off when we in the United States, working with Israel, go into countries and impose the governments that we want on those countries. There's hardly anything that I can imagine more brutal and savage and bad than that. So certainly I wouldn't want to live under the rule of the Ayatollah, but I also don't want Israel and the CIA picking Iran's leaders for it.
But all right. Do you want to ask a question of Alan?
I have a question for Professor Dershowitz,
sure.
If I could.
Sure, please.
No question? Or you want to ask a question?
I want to ask? Yes, I definitely want to ask a question.
Lay the question. Ask it.
Okay. So the resolution that we're debating, that we're asking everybody to vote on, is that the United States should go and bomb Iran's nuclear facilities. But isn't it true that the reason you want that is because you actually want the United States and Israel to go in, as you told Newsmax 3 weeks ago, and facilitate? You want to remove the government of Iran and replace it with the more pro-Israel government, right? That's your real goal.
No, there's no question that it's a two-step process. That be very clear about it. I want to be very clear that first step is if the current Iranian regime remains the regime, I don't want them to have nuclear weapons. But if we could bring about regime change, I would prefer that to bombing or destroying the nuclear reactor. We wouldn't have to. The Shah was oppressing his own people. He wasn't trying to export Islamic oppression to the rest of the Middle East and ultimately to the rest of the world, because he calls the United States the great Satan. So yes, I would like to see regime change. It would be good for the Iranian people, and you haven't answered the question. What if it were true? What if it were true?
Right, hypothetically,
don't interrupt me. Hypothetically, what if you could conduct a poll, and I could conduct a poll, and it would be an honest poll, and the conclusion was that 70% of Iranian people would prefer to see the Shah or the Shah's son replace the current Ayatollah regime, and that what you were propping up essentially was a regime that is against the wishes of the Iranian people as well. What would you, how would you respond to that?
Nobody has any idea.
It's not a question of democracy because we don't know what democracy would produce in Iran. We've never had it.
Exactly. I totally agree with that last statement. Nobody knows what democracy would produce in Iran. But the only thing that I would ask you when you go to vote, because what he's telling you is the real purpose of this bombing campaign is regime change.
No.
And if you, yes, that is what you're saying
what
is
I
your
said.
Real motive.
Let me answer.
There is no plan that would actually achieve any benefits that they want to achieve without removing the current Iranian government. That's what he said to Newsmax, was the only way we can achieve these benefits that we're trying to achieve is if we change the government, even though the current government had an agreement with the United States that was working. So I would ask you,
it wasn't working.
When you go to vote on whether or not you think that the United States efforts over the last 50 years to bring regime change to the world or to bomb other countries in this world has turned out to be good for those countries, has turned out to be good for those regions, and has turned out to be good for the United States. And if you think the answer is yes, vote with him. Go vote with him to have another one of these kinds of wars, because that is what he's advocating.
I don't care how you vote.
Okay,
that's
okay,
up to you.
Professor Dershowitz, we do care how you vote, but you want to respond to that.
There are two independent goals. One does not depend on the other. I think it would be very difficult to achieve regime change. That's why I want to make sure that the current regime doesn't have a nuclear arsenal.
Okay.
The second stage, which is a desirable thing for the people of Iran and for the world and for the Middle East, is to have regime change and to introduce some form of democracy to Iran.
Okay, we heard
with
about
elections
the, yes.
and not theocracy.
My moderator's prerogative to ask two brief questions, one of each. Glenn Greenwald, do you disagree strongly with those who claim that the record shows that Iran is Nazi-like toward Israel and wishes and wants and would further the goal of destroying Israel as a state? Do you agree with that view or disagree?
I think Israel hates a lot of its enemies. They hated Saddam Hussein. They wanted him gone. They wanted Syria and Assad gone. And I think Iran hates Israel as well. They're enemies. There's no question about that, which is precisely why Alan Dershowitz wants the United States military to go and take out another enemy of Israel and replace it with a region like a government like Saudi Arabia, like the United Arab Emirates, like Egypt, that are dictatorships that answer to the West and do Israel's bidding. And that is an extremely dangerous way to continue to conduct foreign policy. And I think all of history is on my side.
So you're thinking Iran is a danger to Israel? It is a danger to Israel, Iran.
I mean, for a long time, we were told that Saudi Arabia hated Israel. They had the same devotion to destroying Israel as Iran does. And Saudi Arabia is now engaged in diplomatic relations because of the attempt to bring Saudi Arabia into the international community. If you go and look at the other option, my option is not some illusory option. It actually happened in reality. I read you the studies that when there was an Iran deal to lift sanctions on them and bring them back into the international community, every single inspection agency, including the IAEA, that tried to convince the world that Saddam Hussein didn't have nuclear weapons before 2002, says that Iran gave up its nuclear aspirations, was allowing inspectors into those facilities. And that's what I think is a far more promising option than starting another war in the Middle East.
Don't you actually think, and tell the truth now, don't you actually think it would be better if Israel didn't exist as the nation state of the Jewish people?
No, I don't. You absolutely know? Don't think that. I've never suggested that anything like that in my life. And if I wanted to advocate that, I would have no problem with telling everybody I do in favor of that. I don't hide what I think, unlike you, when you're advocating for bombing when you really want regime change.
Let me put the question a little differently.
I have a brief question for you, Professor Dershowitz. Do you see an irony in your stating that Iran is the new Nazi Germany, But alongside your confidence that all we have to do is destroy the nuclear facility and this new Nazi Germany will then be so they will then no longer try for nuclear facility.
I do not believe that Iran is the new Nazi Germany. I do not believe that there will ever be another Nazi Germany because of Israel. Israel has the strength and the ability that the Jewish community did not have in the 1930s. It would prevent Iran from becoming the new Nazis. If they could, they would. And don't believe me, believe them.
I'm sorry.
Let me finish, please. Yes, Elie Wiesel once said, "Always believe the threats of your enemies more than the promises of your friends." And the Jewish people have learned from terrible experiences to believe the threats of their enemies. And Iran has threatened genocide, destruction of Israel, the end of the Israeli people, and the end of the Jewish people. And Israel has to take that seriously. And the United States, as Israel's closest ally, has to help them avoid that genocide.
Okay, apologies. Apologies for keeping you waiting in the audience. Let's start over here. Please ask a question. No need to identify yourself.
Sure. First of all, I can't let pass, Glenn, your assertion that Iran is not a militant force in the world. Just ask the people of Lebanon. You live in Brazil. It is the number one place for a Lebanese diaspora, and that's because Iran and its proxy, Hezbollah, has totally ruined life for the Lebanese. So here are my questions. One is, can you square the contradiction, Glenn, in two of your statements? One is that the United States, maybe Israel, have conspired to force Iran into desperation into pursuing a nuclear policy. You cited those statistics from the Washington Post. They now have 7,000 scientists and billions of dollars. There is a momentum. There is a desperation. And yet, they're always so far away. They're so desperate that they're never going to get nuclear weapons. We always say they're going to get nuclear weapons. It never happens. Just like North Korea was. We always said they would get nuclear weapons, and guess what? They got nuclear weapons. So one is, as a debater, you don't have to be logically consistent, but will you at least acknowledge it's a logical inconsistency to say that Iran is so desperate to get the weapons, and yet you also paint a picture where they're not going to?
But no, excuse me. Dershowitz. That's your question.
I have a question for Dershowitz.
Forgive me, sir. You only get one question. The question is put to Glenn. Answer the question, Glenn.
So first of all, you're extremely confused about the studies that I cited. They had nothing to do with Iran. The massive increase in the amount of money being spent to develop nuclear weapons and to hire scientists to develop nuclear weapons was not in Iran, but in Iraq. And all of that happened after the Israeli strike in 1981 on the Iraqi nuclear reactor. That is when Iraq decided that it needed nuclear weapons because there was a country in the region called Israel that had shown they believed in the right to attack any country that they want. Secondly, I didn't say that Iran has never exhibited any aggression. In fact, I said the opposite, that they definitely have. I said, however, that it is bizarre to me to be a citizen of the United States and to accuse other countries of being maniacal about war and constantly starting war when no country on the planet has started more wars or has pursued more wars over the last 50 years than the United States. What I was saying was disputing Professor Dershowitz's attempt to depict Iran as this completely irrational, utterly apocalyptic, extremist regime, completely unhinged from any rational considerations, willing to blow up the entire world. Nothing suggests that they do that. In fact, their retaliation against Israel was far more constrained, the one we just saw, than most countries in the world would have launched after their embassy was bombed. It doesn't mean Iran is a good country or a nice country. It means that the depiction of them as this Nazi Germany, and I don't understand why if he's admitting now they're not Nazi Germany, why the whole beginning of his speech was wanting you to think what we should do if there was another Nazi Germany. Exactly. They're not Nazi Germany. And that's why the paradigm of, what we would have do with Hitler, what would we do with Nazi Germany, is totally inapplicable because we don't have another Nazi Germany in the Middle East. Like I said, every time they want you to start a new war, they tell you that this new leader is the new Hitler, and it never proves to be true.
Okay, can I respond to that, please?
Comment.
Can I respond to that? Okay.
Yes, and that's what we always do.
Screenwalt said that that Iran knew that its drones would be intercepted. That is so preposterous. Iran could not have known that Jordan, that Saudi Arabia, that other countries would stop the drones. They intended to murder civilians all through Israel, including Arab civilians and Israeli civilians. And he says the reason was because Israel bombed the embassy. No, Israel didn't bomb the embassy. It bombed a building that was distantly associated with the embassy that was being used as a military headquarters. And let's remember who started that. Which is the first country that took over another country's embassy? I think it's called Iran. And it started with the Ayatollahs taking American prisoners hostages, American diplomats hostages. So don't tell me that Iran deliberately sent a few kites up in order to somehow send a message to Israel, but it never intended to kill anybody. That's absurd. And Israel had the perfect right at that point, legally and morally, to retaliate overwhelmingly. Proportionality does not require, when somebody sends 300 rockets and drones, that you send 280. They could send 10,000 in response. What proportionality means is that when you're attacking a target that has both civilians and military, that you have to evaluate the military value of the target against the civilian casualties that were anticipated. Iran declared war on Israel by sending all those rockets. Thankfully, Israel, Jordan, the United States, and other countries deflected those and prevented all these deaths from occurring. But you cannot sit here and justify the claim that Iran did not want to kill Israelis, that it sent these hundreds of drones knowing they would all be miraculously stopped. Can you justify that?
Yeah, what I want to say is if Iran has such a primitive army that they're not capable of landing even a single missile inside Israel because all they have is a bunch of crappy drones and slow missiles that can be removed from the sky by Jordan and by the United Arab Emirates, then they're hardly an imposing country. The reality is
all
that
you need is
Hezbollah...
One, all you need is one to
Alan,
get through.
Alan, please.
One,
Hezbollah has hundreds of, tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of highly sophisticated missiles pointed directly at every single major Israeli city, including Tel Aviv. If Iran wanted to do a kind of response against Israel that you're suggesting they wanted, they had that capability and they didn't because they're a rational, restrained country that didn't want to end up in a world war. I know. The only rational, restrained countries are America, Israel, and the West. That's what your media tells you all the time, so I know that you believe that. But there are actually other rational, restrained countries in the world, too. You're always told there's a new Hitler in Iran, there's a new Hitler in Russia, there's a new Hitler named Hamas, there's a new Hitler in Syria, and you believe it all the time, and you stand up and you cheer all those evil, irrational countries.
As I said,
if you look at who the ones are who are starting wars, it is your country, the United States, and along with Israel as well. And that is just the reality if you remove yourself from Western propaganda.
Our next question. Question here, please.
Right. After the U.S. assassinated Qasem Soleimani, many predicted that U.S. and Iran would get into a war. That would be disastrous, but that never happened. Why would it be the case that the U.S. can get away with taking out Iranian nuclear facilities without triggering a war?
I guess it's your question, Alan.
Oh, well, targeted killings are preferable, obviously, to mass killings. And if you can target the scientists who are about to endanger the civilians in your country without endangering civilians, that's far less undesirable than massive attacks. And Israel did manage to, and the United States did manage to kill people who are in charge of terrorism from countries, and Israel did manage to destroy the North Korean nuclear facility that had been sent to Syria with minimum damage and no retaliation. And so the idea that if the United States, with Israel's help, were to surgically destroy or postpone, you know, you can never destroy completely, totally, the potential for nuclear proliferation. But neither Iraq nor Syria has developed a nuclear bomb since they were destroyed by Israel. And if the United States were to surgically attack the six or seven areas that are mostly far away and destroy the current nuclear potential arsenal, it could postpone the development of a nuclear arsenal by 10 years or 15 years, and that's an eternity when it comes to saving lives. So I still argue that that would be the least worst of the very bad alternatives that are facing the United States and Israel today.
Any comment from you, Glenn?
Yeah, I just want to say, like, this is the contradiction at the heart of this propaganda to try and convince you to send your own government, your own military to go attack Israel enemy in the Middle East, which is, on the one hand, we're being told that Iran is this religiously extremist, apocalyptic, monstrous cult that just was willing to blow up the world. And yet, on the other hand, you're supposed to believe that if the United States just goes and drops a few bombs on Iran and takes out all their nuclear facilities, killing however many Iranians we kill in the process, that they're just going to do nothing. They're just going to accept it and say, oh, I guess the United States bombed us. You remember, before the Iraq war, we were told that that war would end in a month or 2 months at the most. And we ended up fighting in Iraq for years. That is always what is done when they want you to convince you to do new wars. Oh, don't worry. It's just going to be a few people who die. It's going to be over very quickly. If Iran really is this great threat that he's telling you they are, this wildly irrational, crazed, religious extremist regime, don't you think that Iran will actually do some pretty extreme things in response to having the United States go and bomb it the way that we would do the same? Remember what happened we did after September 11th, a one-day attack on the United States. We launched 20 years worth of war in multiple Muslim countries all over the world. Why would Iran just sit by and accept our going and bombing their country without starting major instability and major war in the Middle East? There is always these contradictions at the heart of a war they want to sell you. It's like a used car. Oh, don't worry. This used car is fantastic. And then you get it and everything breaks down. That has been the case for every war they've sold you over the last 50
years. There's a very simple answer. There's a very simple answer. And it's the answer you don't like. And that is, if the United States and Israel were to destroy Iran's nuclear arsenal in its current form, it would be a very important first step toward regime change. And regime change would bring about a glorious peace throughout the Middle East.
Okay.
That is impossible with Iran and the current regime in charge.
Just like happened with Iraq.
Let me finish. Now a movement toward peace between Israel, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, possibly other countries as well. And if Iran were out of the picture, if the current regime were out of the picture, Israel could make peace with Lebanon. Israel could make peace with Iraq. It would be the best possible thing that could happen for world peace. Is it certain? Absolutely not. But is it fairly certain that if Iran remains in power and develops a nuclear arsenal, we're in for a catastrophic reaction in terms of not only the Middle East, but in many other parts of the world?
Next question.
The question is the risk-benefit ratio.
Okay.
I think this is a hard question. Glenn thinks it's an easy question. If you agree with him,
it's
an easy question. Vote for him.
All right. Next question.
Good evening, gentlemen. My question is for Professor Dershowitz.
Yeah.
And it touches on some of the necessary practicalities. The Iranian nuclear facilities like Natanz are deeply, deeply buried.
Yeah,
quite possibly beyond the reach of conventional ordnance.
That's right.
And if the only reliable way, as you said, was to strike them, would you be willing to see the U.S. conduct a nuclear first strike?
No.
Undoubtedly resulting in fallout spread by the prevailing winds?
No, absolutely not. I don't think either Israel or the United States should have a first strike nuclear attack. And that's why Israel asked the United States for bunker-busting bombs, bombs that are conventional, but that can burrow through the ground and destroy the vast majority of the potential arsenal. Would it be complete? Of course not. But I would never favor either the United States or Israel taking a first nuclear step unless it were absolutely necessary to their self-preservation.
Then how would you get at those facilities that he just referenced were so far underneath the surface that no
bombs.
Okay, so let me just say that you can paint a very glorious, optimistic, sunny picture of any war. And what I would hope you will do is look at all the studies that I read that said what caused more than anything else a desire for nuclear weapons in the Middle East was when Israel did the kind of strike that he's talking about doing in Iran, in Iraq, because the more you signal to countries that they are going to be vulnerable without nuclear weapons, that is when they say, oh, if I were North Korea, they wouldn't be attacking me. If I were Pakistan, they wouldn't be attacking me because they have nuclear weapons. That's what provides this nuclear arms race, is creating a militarized world.
That's just dead wrong historically. The reason the Saudis want a nuclear arsenal now is to protect themselves against Iran. If Iran didn't have nuclear potential and the and be just months or who knows away from a nuclear arsenal, the Saudis would not be asking for it and the Emirates would not be asking for it. So it's exactly the opposite.
Next question.
A world without nuclear weapons. And you talked before about how everybody voted for a nuclear free zone except the United States and Israel. Of course, because the United States and Israel are the only countries in the Middle East that have nuclear weapons. What do you expect? Of course, countries without nuclear weapons are going to vote for a nuclear-free zone. That doesn't take a lot of intelligence.
Next question.
Yeah, this question is for Alan Dulles. Alan Dershowitz. So considering we have 30,000 U.S. troops, service men and women in the Middle East, in Jordan, Syria, Iraq, UAE, how many of these service men and women are you willing and comfortable to sacrifice for Israel?
I'm not going to answer.
In the immediate retaliation that Iran is definitely going to take, and with its militias in the region against our U.S. servicemen and women in the region.
You have forfeited your right to ask me a question by calling me Alan Dulles. I'm not going to respond to name calling. I was a strong opponent of both the Dulles brothers, and I'm simply not going to dignify your absurd ad hominem question with a serious answer. Who's next?
I don't support that ad hominem, but I do want to make a comment about the substance just very quickly, which is that when I keep talking about what happened with the Iraq war, I just want everyone to remember that Iran is a country three times as large, with far more sophisticated military capabilities, not just inside Iran, but all throughout the Middle East. And if you thought that the Iraq war was going to last 2 weeks and you saw it last for 15 years because of the willingness of people to react when their own country is attacked and bombed and defended, what Iraq was able to do was a tiny fraction of what Iran will be able to do and likely will do all throughout the Middle East, including, as the questioner suggested, where our own soldiers are. This is a fantasy war he's selling you and not the real war, as we've seen throughout history over and over. It's so easy to make claims about the future, but none of it has ever happened in the past. We've never had a dream war like the one he's selling
that
you.
Assumes,
so please look at history and see what happens when we do these things.
That assumes no regime change. If you have regime change, you have a different situation. The United States bombed Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Berlin, and we had regime change.
Next question.
Suddenly, America's two greatest allies were Germany and Japan. And so, yes, you can defeat an ideology, and yes, you can defeat a regime and bring about peace by the right surgical military approach.
Next question.
Hey, this question is for Glenn. Let's say that an Iran deal did in the past or could in the future actually work as intended. The last time around, it didn't stop the IRGC from murdering political dissidents, raping women as political punishment, and hanging gay people from ropes in the town square. So how would you reconstitute a deal that didn't condemn these people to living under a regime that, according to the people actually living under it, does in fact feel a lot like a tyrannical, fundamentalist, Nazi-like regime?
So I guess I would say to you that if you think the United States should go around the world changing all the regimes that are extremely barbaric and repressive to its people, we shouldn't only do Iran. Some of the countries that are closest.
But how about ones that
some of the countries
terrorism.
That are closest.
Alan, let him finish his answer.
Some of the countries that are closest to the United States, the ones that he has been citing as the good countries, the one he wants to replicate, like Saudi Arabia. Go look at how dissidents are treated in Saudi Arabia. Do you think women are well treated in Saudi Arabia? Do you think gay people are treated well in Saudi Arabia? Or go look at Egypt, where dissidents are murdered by the hundreds or the thousands. There's zero press freedom. There's not a single dissident in Egypt that is anything but arrested or killed. So this idea that the United States is going to go around the world and we're going to take out the bad regimes, even though some of our closest allies and partners haven't always have been and still are some of the most savage I think it's an important point, because if you think that the reason to go bomb Iran is because they're an oppressive government, then we should go bomb a lot of countries in the world, be the world's policemen, take out all of the countries. Iran is by far not the most repressive regime on the planet. They're extremely repressive. You do not want to be a dissident in Iran, that's for sure. There are a lot of countries that are at least as bad, if not worse, including the ones that he wants to replicate in the Middle East. The reality is he doesn't care, and the U.S. government doesn't care if a country is dictatorial or tyrannical. We have supported and installed dictatorial regimes all throughout the world. We don't care if a country is free. What we care about is whether the dictatorship serves the interests of Israel and the United States. So that is what regime change is about.
You put your finger on the precise question. In a world where we judge things not by good, better, best, but by worse, worser, worsest, and unbelievably bad, the question is, what's worse? A country like Saddam Hussein's, where he oppresses its own people, and which is terrible, and we shouldn't have gone to war with Saddam Hussein. We went against the wrong country. It should have been Iran, or a country which exports terrorism around the world. And if you're going to be a policeman, you don't police people for what they do to their own citizens. There are courts for that. There are international courts. But you do make sure that countries can't hurt you and can't hurt your allies. And the difference between Iran and Iraq, or between Iran and Saudi Arabia, is Iran is the greatest exporter of terrorism in the history of the world. It's trying to hurt us. It's trying to hurt its neighbors. It's trying to hurt its allies. Whereas other dictatorships just work internally. All they want to do, even North Korea, all it cares about is preserving its little hermit empire. But they're not a great danger to us. Iran is a great, great danger to the United States, to Israel, to the countries in the Middle East, and to world peace. And if you can't understand the difference between countries that endanger others and countries that just endanger themselves. Now, if you endanger people as well, if you have a combination, if you have three things going for you: one, you're repressive of your own people; two, the people themselves want regime change, they want to see the Ayatollahs thrown out; and three, they pose a great danger to other people, that trifecta is the perfect recipe for regime change, not to try to protect people from themselves. No, we shouldn't have regime change in Saudi Arabia because they don't endanger us or the people around them, but we should have regime change in Iran because they fit those three criteria.
Can I just very quickly, I'm sorry, I want to get to all the questions, just very quickly. I'm glad, so glad he's finally saying that what he really wants you to do is to vote for regime change. There's a lot of examples of what happens when we try and reduce regime change. We were told we were going to go and make Iraq a better place. We were going to make Libya a better place. We were going to make Syria a better place. If you want to see the results of what really happens when the United States goes in and tries to change the regime of other countries, and those are much less powerful and smaller countries than Iran, go look at Iraq, go look at
Libya, go look at Syria, and then you decide whether you want to replicate that yet again in the Middle East.
In Iran, the answer is yes.
You do want to do that in Iran.
Apologies to those people who are still in line. This, unfortunately, will have to be our final question. Go ahead, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. So look, ever since post-FDR, we've had a policy of kind of advocating for a first strike. After FDR died and we built the nuclear bomb, Bertrand Russell actually advocated for the United States to bomb the Soviet Union before they were able to develop the nuclear bomb as a way of proving moral superiority. And then you've had people like Henry Kissinger afterwards who, in their NSSM 200, blankly call for depopulation and that the United States has to take the role of starting wars and coups around the world
to keep the population in check.
What's your question? What is your question?
Here's my question. We are influenced by neoconservative thinking of what you're saying that we need to attack first. Therefore, don't you think Putin should attack the United States first, given that, you know, we're funding and arming Ukraine? So doesn't your logic, Mr. Dershowitz, also apply to the other countries that we are going after?
I want to answer the question. Excuse me. We heard your question.
Okay. How many men and women would you commit, American soldiers?
Your question has been asked, sir.
It's a hard point, obviously. We do have, you know, great risks when we engage in any kind of preemptive or preventive attack. That always is the case. What I'm here to tell you is that there are great risks in not taking preemptive and preventive action. Those great risks were manifested by the outbreak of the Second World War, which was eminently preventable if we had just enforced the Versailles Treaty. And so I think we have to always carefully balance when we take preventive action. And the three criteria that I have talked about, it seems to me, satisfy those concerns.
Okay.
Make sure the people themselves in the country want regime change. You have to make sure that the people in the country are deeply, deeply oppressed, and you have to make sure that the country is posing a great, great risk to others. And yes, there is the possibility that if you establish prevention as a paradigm, other countries will do the same. I'm about to publish a book called The Preventive State, How to Avoid Cataclysmic Events Without Giving Governments Too Much Power. And I go through all these issues about when it's appropriate to take preventive action. And I acknowledge it's a difficult question. The difference between us is I acknowledge it's hard and difficult and nuanced, and my distinguished opponent seems to think it's
okay.
I'm
going to do something politically incorrect and announce that we have an Iranian in the House who would like to ask the final question. Take it away, Miss Iran.
Thank you so much for making the exception for me. My question actually has a few different sides. I'm probably one of the just few, if not the only Iranian here today.
It's only one question, please.
Yes, of course. My question is about your statement that Iran is a rational country and they would do something that is rational. I actually do believe you're right. What I have in mind is your understanding of their rationality. They are the enemy of the United States as they are the enemy of Israel. It's not one way or another. It's both of them. I was personally took out of my schoolyard in front of 300 people just because I didn't chant this to America when I was 13 years old. So are they a rational country? Yes, they are. But are you going to like the rational? I'm assuming not.
I think your question has been clear. It's intended for Mr. Greenbaum. Greenwald, yes, go ahead.
So obviously, every time the United States wants to attack a new country, there are always dissidents or exiles from those countries. We constantly heard from Iraqi exiles during the run-up to the war in Iraq who would appear and say, I hate my government, and they often hated their government for very good reason. That does not change the fact, and I have no doubt that people who live in Iran are oppressed. I mean, that is not even a debatable point, just like
my question is I'm going to get to your point because your argument is based on the fact that there are rationals.
You asked your question.
There are
all kinds of repressive regimes in the world that will produce exiles. You can hear from Saudi exiles. You can hear from Egyptian exiles. You can hear from Emirati exiles. You can hear from exiles from South America and from Asia and all over the world, people who leave their country and say that their government is repressive. And it's absolutely true. The problem is that war, going around bombing every country, trying to change every other government that we think is bad or that people stand up and say, I'm from that country and is bad, like we heard from Iraqi exiles, does not lead to better outcomes. You can sell the war that way. You can say, oh, we're going to go to war. We heard this, all the same stuff from Saddam Hussein. He repressed his people. He exported terrorism in the Middle East. We need to change his government. Once we change his government, there's going to be democracy flourishing all throughout the Middle East. We ended up killing close to 1 million Iraqis, if not more, and lost tens of thousands of people either to casualties or to death from our own country, none of which was told to the American people before they sold that war as well. So, yes, you can hear every, and it's not just Iraq, by the way. It was the war in Libya, which we were told we're just going in to put a no-fly zone over Benghazi. We changed that regime. We turned away and left, and that country ended up with anarchy and slavery and all kinds of migrant crises. We destroyed Syria with the CIA war, where we fought on the same side as Al-Qaeda and ISIS because there were Syrian exiles saying Assad is the greatest dictator. We were told, no, Assad is the new Hitler. This is propaganda that is given to you over and over and over, and I think our responsibility as Americans is to finally say we are not supporting more wars in the name of this propaganda.
I'm sorry. We've gone over time with the Q&A. We're going to go to the summation portion of the evening. Each side gets 5 minutes to summarize, and according to the rules, the affirmative goes first. Take it away, Alan. 5 minutes of summary.
I believe that Iran is a rational actor. I have said in my writings that Iran is the smartest, cleverest, most rational enemy that Israel and the United States have had for a long, long time. But it is a deeply evil, the regime, a deeply evil rational actor. And we must deal with a deeply, deeply evil. You don't have to compare things to Hitler to believe that it's a deeply evil regime. I think that Russia is a deeply evil regime. It's not Hitler. There's no comparable regime to Hitler. No regime today are building gas chambers or taking children and putting them in crematoriums. No, there's nothing like Hitler, and nobody should ever make comparisons to Hitler. The point I make is that Iran, if it could, would do what Hitler wanted to do. It would try to end the presence of the Jewish people in the Middle East. And Glenn has acknowledged now, and I was glad to hear him say that, that he doesn't believe that the nation state of the Jewish people, Israel, doesn't have a right to exist. It does have a right to exist. But an Iran with a nuclear arsenal will make it impossible for Israel to continue to exist, because the Rafsanjani was right. Israel is a one-bomb state. All Iran has to do is send 3,000 drones with nuclear warheads, and one of them hit Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, and it will kill millions of Israelis and Israeli Arabs as well. The cataclysmic impact of a nuclear-armed Iran is so great that it really argues for some degree of risk-taking. Now, we live in a world where it's so much easier not to take risks. As I mentioned, using the German experience of the 1930s, nobody was really blamed for allowing Hitler to emerge and kill 50 or so, how many million people there were. But if there had been an attack on Germany and 10,000 civilians, German civilians, had been killed, the people who did it would have been regarded as warmongers, and history would never have been able to judge them, even though now, in retrospect, we know that would have been the right thing. Yes, Iran is a rational regime, and that's why we have to deal with it in a rational way. And the rational way is to destroy its most potent potential weapon, and that is its nuclear arsenal. And yes, people have cried wolf for a long time and said that we're close to the nuclear arsenal, but we could make the mistake of missing that. And if we make the mistake of missing that, then you get a North Korea which exports nuclear armaments to terrorist groups. And so on balance, it's absolutely essential that we think hard and make the right decision here. And again, I want to end as I started by acknowledging this is a very difficult issue, and one should not move toward any kind of preventive war without taking into account all the risks. And Glenn is right in outlining all these risks. There are real potential risks in taking preventive action against Iran. My point tonight, right from the beginning, has been to emphasize that there are real potential risks in not taking actions. If we could accept Glenn's point, and he said it at the beginning, that we should sit down and have a rational discussion with Iran and hope that we can persuade Iran to do the right thing. We can't do that. Whether it was right or wrong to have the Iran nuclear deal, whether it was right or wrong to get out of the nuclear deal, that's yesterday's news. What's essential now is to live in today's world and to compare the risks of taking no action with the risks of taking what is a potentially dangerous action. And I'm here to argue that although it's a close case, the costs of being wrong by not taking action exceed the costs of being wrong in this case by taking surgical military action. Thank you.
Somebody from Glenn, you can, usually you take the podium. You want to sit?
Okay. So the reason I began the debate at that podium by reading a bunch of studies and historical examples is because I know how easy it is to sell wars to a population that has been hearing for decades that there's some country we are about to attack, we want to attack, who's so evil and is our enemy. And we constantly watch the government and the media being able to sell these wars to people by getting them all pent up with fear-mongering and then fake promises about how easy the war is going to be. And that's why I started by reading how since 2005, everything you've heard tonight has been issuing from the Israeli government and America's Israel supporters that, oh, Iran is months getting away from getting a nuclear weapon. If we don't strike them in the next 2 months, it means they're absolutely going to proliferate. And none of that has ever happened. He says the agreement with Iran, a potential agreement with Iran, is in the past. It is in the past. That's why we should learn from it. He who forgets history is doomed to repeat its mistakes. Everything that I read you about the weapons inspectors, about the agencies, about Western Europe, all said the same thing, that when we integrated Iran back into the international community, they opened up their nuclear facilities, let inspectors in, and there was no progress being made toward nuclear weapons because countries only seek nuclear weapons when they feel threatened. That was the example I focused on so much because I knew Professor Dershowitz would rely on it so much, hold it up as the model that he wants to show you. Oh, look, Israel struck the Iraqi facility in 1981. Let's do it again. The problem was, as everything I've read you demonstrated, is that it was the striking of Iraq's nuclear facility in 1981 that led to this massive attempt, this increased attempt on the part of Saudi Arabia and Iraq and other countries around the world to try and get nuclear weapons. The more we tell the world, we are the United States, we bomb whoever we want, we go around the world and we just bomb whoever we feel like bombing, that is when other countries are going to be incentivized. Now, it is amazing to me to sit in 2024 and hear someone make all these starry promises about how easy regime change will be, about how great it will be. You have so many examples of regime change wars that have been sold to you in the last 20 years. Everything he's saying about what will happen in Iran, oh, everything will flourish in the Middle East, there will be peace in the Middle East, everything is going to break out, that was all said with Iraq. And the only real outcome of regime change in Iraq, aside from all of the deaths that it caused, was that there was a power vacuum in the Middle East that led to ISIS, and it drove Iraq further into the arms of the Iranians. And we spent 15 years and trillions of dollars in endless wars when we were told, like he's trying to convince you now, oh, it's a very easy operation. We're just going to be a month there. We're just going to bomb them, and then we're going to win, and we're going to walk away. Now, I do think that the point of the United States and the role that we're playing in the world is one we haven't spent much time focusing on, but one that we should end with.
Because what he's saying is, anytime that we look at any place in the world, we don't like the government's not doing what we say. Again, we don't have any problems with dictators or with tyrannical governments. In fact, the core of American foreign policy since the end of World War II, throughout the Cold War and then into the War on Terror, is we want dictatorial regimes. It's much easier to install them because they're there to keep the population, many of whom would be anti-American because of their perception of all the wars that we start, under control. Those dictators are there in all these wonderful countries that we're told we should replicate, like Saudi Arabia and Egypt and all those Gulf states. They're there to keep the population down, and we're happy with it. We support those countries. We don't go around the world attacking other countries or trying to remove their government because we want to give those people freedom and democracy. We only do it when we see a government that doesn't do our bidding. And that was fine to do at the end of World War II when we had supremacy. Maybe it was fine when the Cold War fell and we had supremacy in the 1990s. This is now a multipolar world. If you look at why so many countries are going to China, are joining BRICS, are leaving the Western influence, it's because of the resentment that this kind of mentality is spawning. What do you think the world is going to do as they watch the United States continuously assert its unilateral and singular right to start wars against other countries who are not attacking us? Because we have been told over and over since birth that our country is the shining beacon on the hill, that we are the emblem of democracy, that it's only other countries, those bad countries like Iran and Russia and China, where bad things happen. We're the good countries. Our wars are good. I think if there's anything that the last 20 years of history should tell us is that we have to start thinking critically about all of this propaganda, thinking critically about what the role of our own country is in the world, and all of the devastation and misery and suffering and bloodshed and instability that happens whenever our government or our media convinces us to support yet another war. This would be the worst of all of those wars because of how big Iran is, because of how sophisticated their military is. And if you thought Iraq was bad, think about what bombing Iran will entail and make your decision based on that.
All right. I have in my hand the Soliform Tootsie Roll that will be tossed at the winner of this Oxford-style debate. Those of you on the right side here, would you please open your machines? Brett, please open the final vote. Yes, no, or undecided. The United States should strike Iran's nuclear facilities. Please vote this section. Meanwhile, again, I want to announce to those who forked over the money that we do have an after party that's part of the tradition of the Soul Forum. Both debaters are invited. Alan, it's past my bedtime, too, because I'm pushing 80. But can you make it? I hope you can come to the after party. He's checking his time. Glenn, you can come. And those of you who are coming to the after party will get a chance to chat in greater depth with these two guys who clearly are extremely approachable and certainly quite passionate. And if you have a ticket, please come to the after party. We'd love to see you. We sold, you know, the 110 tickets, and that's the absolute limit. But unfortunately, we couldn't find a place that could accommodate everybody, so we just sold out at 110 tickets. So do come to the after party. Meanwhile, you are voting yes, no, undecided. And now, as well, while those in the middle section are voting, please, those in the middle section, please vote. I just want to announce what is to come at the Soul Forum. Next month, we're taking the show on the road to New Hampshire to Porcupine Festival, where we will be doing two Soul Forum debates and where I will be doing a presentation. In fact, I will be participating in both Soul Forum debates. In one case, I'll be debating David Friedman, son of Milton Friedman. Go on our website to find out more about those debates. On Monday, July 15th, now the middle section, please open your machines to vote. The middle section, please vote. On Monday, July 15th, science journalist Matt Ridley versus virologist Stephen Goldstein. He will defend the resolution. It is likely. Guys, please quiet down so that those who want to vote can contemplate how they want to vote. The middle section is now voting. The resolution for July 15th will read, it is likely that SARS-CoV virus originated in the Wuhan laboratory in China. The resolution in that case will be about the origin of the SARS-CoV virus in the Wuhan laboratory in China. On Monday, August 12th, Art Laffer of the Laffer Curve will defend the resolution. Among the candidates actively running for president, Donald Trump is the best choice. Those of you on the far side, please vote. On the far side, please vote. Brett, are you still here? Brett? You're here, okay. Keep me track of the voting. Okay, now everybody who is eligible to vote, who voted the first time, please vote. Brett, you're watching it? Okay. Alan, please stick around. I might have to... Alan, are you coming to the party? Professor Dershowitz. Professor Dershowitz is going to try to come to the party. Okay. And that's good. And it reminds me that I've occasionally been asked, what is the dress code at the Soul Forum? And I thought about it, and the dress code is simply try not to come naked. And most of you, and you've all succeeded, and that's also the rule at Prophet. How do we stand? And it's all set? Okay, then bring the results up to me. Drum roll, please. Oh my God. Okay, oh, wow. All right, it was very close. The United States should strike Iran's nuclear facilities. The yes vote went from 14% to 24%, so it picked up 9.7 points. The no vote went from 56 to 66, so it picked up 10 points for a rather narrow win, but it does mean that Alan, We all vote for Alan Dershowitz to come to the party.